Chapter 17. The NOAA ship Benjamin Franklin limped along like a sailor who'd been in a bar brawl. The tug of war with the whirlpool had taken its toll on the ship's engines, which had to be babied so they wouldn't break down completely. The Throckmorton trailed several hundred yards behind in case the NOAA vessel ran into trouble. As the two ships slowly made their way toward Norfolk, a turquoise-colored utility helicopter with the letters NUMA visible on the fuselage appeared in the western sky. It hovered over the Benjamin Franklin like a hummingbird before touching down on the deck. Four people scrambled out, carrying medical supplies and equipment. Crewmen directed the medical team to the ship's sickbay. None of the injuries sustained when the ship nearly went vertical in the whirlpool were life-threatening. The captain had requested the team to help the ship's paramedic, who had been overwhelmed with the sheer volume of bruises and concussions. The helicopter was refueled, and two crewmen who had suffered broken arms were loaded aboard. Austin thanked the captain for his hospitality. Then he, along with the Trouts, Zavala, and Professor Adler, climbed into the helicopter. Minutes later, they were airborne. The helicopter touched down at National Airport less than 2 hours later. The injured were unloaded into waiting ambulances. The Trouts caught a taxi to their Georgetown townhouse, taking Adler with them as their guest, and Zavala drove Austin to his house on the Potomac River in Fairfax, Virginia, less than a mile from the Central Intelligence Agency headquarters in Langley. They all agreed to meet at 8 the next morning after a good night's rest. Austin lived in a converted Victorian boathouse overlooking the river. He had acquired the turreted building when he worked for the CIA. The mansard-roofed structure was part of an old estate, and the previous owners had let it run down. It had become a waterfront condominium for countless families of mice by the time Austin gutted and redid the interior and restored the exterior to its former glory. The space under the living quarters housed his racing skull and small outboard hydroplane. He dropped his bag in the hall and walked into a spacious living room. His house was an eclectic combination of the old and the new. The authentic, dark wooden colonial furniture contrasted with the whitewashed walls hung with contemporary originals and painterly primitives and charts. Floor-to-ceiling bookcases held the leather-bound sea adventures of Conrad and Melville and the well-worn volumes of the great philosophers he liked to study. Glass cases displayed some of the rare dueling pistols he collected. His extensive collection of music, with a preference for progressive jazz, mirrored his steely coolness, his energy and drive, and his talent for improvisation. He checked his phone for messages. There were a pile of calls, but nothing that couldn't wait. He flicked the stereo on, and Oscar Peterson's frenetic piano fingering filled the room. He poured a drink for himself of his best Añejo tequila, opened the sliding glass door and went out onto the deck with the ice tinkling pleasantly in his glass. He listened to the soft, rippling sounds and breathed into his lungs the misty, flower-scented river air that was so different from the briny scent of the ocean where he spent much of his working days. After a few minutes, he went back into the house, pulled a book on ancient Greek philosophers from a shelf, and opened it to Plato's Allegory of the Cave. In Plato's parable, prisoners chained in a cave can see only the shadows cast by puppets on the wall and can hear the puppeteers moving behind their backs. On that slim evidence, the prisoners must decide what is shadow and what is reality. Similarly, Austin's brain was sorting the strange events of the last few days, trying to impose order on his mental chaos. He kept coming back to the one thing he could grasp: the mysterious ship. He went over to a roll-top desk and powered up his laptop computer. Using the website information from Dr. Adler, he called up the satellite picture of the giant wave area. The image showed that all was quiet. He backed up through the image archives to the date of the Southern Belle's sinking. The two giant waves that had startled Adler were clearly displayed on the date the ship had disappeared. The ship itself was shown as a small blip that was there 1 minute, gone the next. He zoomed the picture out so that it showed a greater area of ocean and saw something he hadn't noticed before. four ships were clustered around the area of the sinking. There was one at each point of the compass, equidistant from one another. He stared at the image for a moment, then backed up a few days. The ships were not there. He jumped ahead to shortly after the sinking. There were only three ships. When he went to a day after the bell went down, no blips were visible. He was like one of Plato's prisoners in the cave, trying to separate reality from appearance, but he had one advantage they didn't. He could call out for help. He picked up the thick Numa directory next to the phone, scanned the listings, and punched in a number on the phone. A man answered. "Hello, Alan. This is Kurt Austin. I just got in from a cruise. Hope I didn't wake you."
"Not at all, Kurt. Nice to hear from you. What can I do for you?"
"Can you make a meeting at my place tomorrow morning around 8? It's quite important."
"Of course."
There was a pause.
"You know what I do?"
Alan Hibbett was one of the dozens of innocuous Numa scientists who toiled anonymously in the heart of the great oceanographic organization, content to do research of vital importance in exotic subjects with little fanfare. A few months earlier, Austin had heard Hibbett speak at a Numa symposium on at-sea communication and environmental monitoring. He'd been impressed with the breadth of the man's knowledge.
"I know very well what you do.
You're a specialist in applied electromagnetism, with expertise in antennae. You're responsible for designing the electronic eyes and ears Numa uses to probe the deep and maintain communications among its far-flung operations. I read your paper on the effect of ground plane size on the radiation patterns produced by reduced surface antennae."
"You did?
I'm flattered. I'm basically a tinkerer. I think of the special assignments team as swashbucklers." Austin and his team were legends around Numa, and Hibbett was stunned at being asked to help. Austin laughed ruefully. His arm muscles were still sore from rescuing Paul Trout, and he was dog-tired. "I think there's more buckle than swash in the team these days. We could really use your expertise."
"I'll be glad to help in any way I can," Hibbett said.
Austin gave Hibbett directions to the boathouse and said he looked forward to seeing him in the morning. He made some notes in a yellow legal pad while the thoughts were fresh in his head. Then he prepared a full pot of Kenyan coffee, put the coffee maker on automatic, and went upstairs to his turret bedroom. He undressed, slid between the cool sheets, and quickly fell asleep. It seemed only minutes before he was awakened by the bright morning sunlight streaming into his bedroom window. He showered and shaved, got dressed comfortably in t-shirt and shorts, and whipped together an order of scrambled eggs and Virginia ham, which he ate on the deck. He had just finished clearing away the dishes when Zavala knocked on the door. The Trouts showed up a few minutes later with Professor Adler. Al Hibbett arrived at the same time. Hibbett was a tall, thin man with a shock of white hair. He was almost painfully shy, and his skin was as pale as marble, both consequences of spending most of his days in a laboratory away from human contact and sunlight. Austin handed each person a mug of coffee and herded them to a round, teakwood table on the deck. Austin could have called the meeting at his office in the green-tinted tower in Arlington that was the center of Numa's operations. But he wasn't ready to answer questions or share his thoughts with anyone outside his innermost circle until he had gathered more facts. He pulled up a chair and gazed longingly at the sun-sparkled river where he usually spent his mornings rowing for exercise, then glanced around the table and thanked everyone for coming. He felt like Van Helsing calling together a strategy meeting to battle Dracula and was tempted to ask if anyone brought the garlic. Instead, he got right to the point. "Something very odd has been going on in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans," he began. "The sea is being stirred up like eggs in a bowl. These disturbances have sunk one ship, and possibly two that we know of, nearly sank another, and have scared a year's growth off some of the people seated around this table, including yours truly." He turned to Adler. "Professor, would you be kind enough to describe the phenomena we've witnessed
and hold forth with some of your theories?
I'd be glad to, Adler said. He recounted the disappearance of the unsinkable Southern Belle and the successful search for the lost ship. He described the satellite evidence confirming the existence of giant waves in the ship's vicinity. Last, and with slightly less enthusiasm, he talked about his theory that the disturbances may not have been of natural origin. As he explained his thoughts, he looked from face to face as if he were searching for a hint of doubt. To his relief, he saw only seriousness and interest.
Normally we might attribute all this strange ocean activity to King Neptune kicking up his heels, but for a couple of things, he said. Satellite imagery suggests that other areas of the oceans have been similarly disturbed, and that there is an unusual symmetry to the disturbances.
Using Austin's laptop, he showed the satellite images of the killer wave concentrations. Austin asked the Trouts to describe their descent into the maelstrom. Again, there was silence as Gamay and Paul took turns telling about being sucked into the vortex and their last-minute rescue.
"You say there was lightning at the time this whirlpool first materialized?"
Hibbett said.
Gamay and Paul nodded. Hibbett's reply was succinct. He only said, "Ah."
Zavala picked up the story thread and told the group about boarding the resurrected ship. Hibbett was keenly interested in his description of the power plant and the damaged electrical framework on deck.
"I wish I could have been there to see it," he said.
"I can do the next best thing," Zavala said.
Moments later, the digital photos he had taken of the mystery ship were displayed on the computer screen. Austin asked Hibbett what he made of the images. The Pneuma scientist stared at the screen with a furrowed brow and asked for a second run-through of the photos.
"It's fairly obvious that a great deal of electrical power is being fed into a central point."
He pointed to the cone-shaped framework.
"It's hard to know what this apparatus is for in its present state."
"Joe described it as a giant spark plug," Austin said. Hibbett scratched his head.
"Probably not.
More like a giant Tesla coil. Many of the circuits that make this thing tick are not visible. Where is the ship now?"
"It sank to the bottom of the sea again," Zavala said.
Hibbett's reaction wasn't what Austin expected. There was excitement in his gray eyes as he rubbed his palms together.
"This beats fiddling around with antennae any day."
He clicked through the computer pictures again, then he glanced around the table.
"Anyone here familiar with the work of Nikola Tesla?"
"I'm the only one who reads popular science on a regular basis," Zavala said. "Tesla invented alternating current."
Tibbett nodded. "He was a Serbian-American electrical engineer. He discovered that you could rotate a magnetic field if you took two coils at right angles and juiced them with AC current out of phase."
"I wonder if you might put that in English," Adler said politely.
Hibbett laughed.
"I'll put it in a historic context. Tesla moved to the United States and worked for Thomas Edison. They became rivals. Edison advocated direct current, and there was a fierce battle. Tesla got the edge when he was commissioned to design the AC generators at Niagara Falls. He sold the patents to his induction motor to George Westinghouse, whose power system was the basis for what we use today. Edison had to be content with the electric light bulb and the phonograph."
"Tesla filed a bunch of wild patents, as I recall," Zavala said.
"That's right.
He was an eccentric genius.
He filed a patent for an unmanned electrically propelled aircraft that could fly at 18,000 miles per hour and could be used as a weapon. He came up with something called Teleforce, which was a death ray that could melt airplane engines at a distance of 250 miles. He did a lot of work on wireless transmission of electricity. He was fascinated by the possibility of focusing electrical force and amplifying its effect. He even claimed to have once produced an earthquake from his lab."
"Tesla may have simply been ahead of his time,
with ballistics missiles and lasers, Austin said. His concepts were sound, but the execution never lived up to the expectations. He's become something of a cult figure in recent years. The conspiracy-minded suspect that various governments, including our own, have been experimenting with the more destructive aspects of Tesla's work. What do you think? Austin said. The conspiracy theorists are missing the boat. Tesla attracted a lot of attention because he was such a flamboyant figure. The work of Laszlo Kovács had far more potential for destruction, in my opinion. Like Tesla, he was a brilliant electrical engineer. He was from Budapest, where Tesla worked in the late 1800s and picked up on his work in the 1930s, concentrating on extra-low-frequency electromagnetic transmission. He became worried about the possibility of electromagnetic warfare. He said that certain transmissions could be used to disrupt the atmosphere and produce severe weather, earthquakes, and all sorts of unpleasant results. He took Tesla to the next level.
In what way?
Kovács actually developed a set of frequencies whereby electromagnetic resonance could be focused and thus amplified by the material surrounding it. They were called the Kovács theorems. He published his findings in a scientific journal, but he refused to make public the complete set of frequencies that would allow the device he described to be built. Other scientists were skeptical of his findings without proof.
It's lucky no one believed him, Professor Adler said. The world has enough trouble controlling the types of warfare we have already.
Some people believed him. The Nazis were very open to ideas of mysticism, the occult, and pseudoscience. Those stories about Nazi archaeologists searching for the Holy Grail are true. They pounced on Kovács and kidnapped him and his family. After the war ended, it was disclosed that they had put him to work in a secret lab on a project to develop a superweapon that would win the war. They lost the war, Austin said. Tesla wasn't the only one with a credibility problem. Kovács apparently failed, too. Hibbett shook his head. It's more complicated than that, Kurt. Papers uncovered after the war suggested that he was on the verge of an electromagnetic warfare breakthrough. Luckily, it never happened.
Why not?
The Russians overran the lab in East Prussia where he was said to be working. But Kovács had already disappeared. After the war, the Soviets carried out research based on the Kovács theorems. The United States was aware of their work and would have loved to talk to Kovács. The significance of electromagnetic radiation was not lost on our military. There was a big conference years ago at the Los Alamos lab to talk about applied weapons technology based on his work.
Home of the Manhattan Project?
That was fitting, Austin said. In more ways than one. The manipulation of electromagnetic rays could be more devastating in its own way than a nuclear device. The military took Kovács very seriously. Electromagnetic pulse weapons were tested during the first Gulf War. Some people claim that those experiments and similar ones conducted by the Soviets caused earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and weather disturbances. That's why I was interested in the bright light flashes in the sky.
What's so significant about the bursts of light? Austin asked.
Many of the cases reported by witnesses to the Soviet and American experiments said they saw an aurora borealis, or great burst of light caused by electromagnetic transmissions, Hibbett said.
Tell us more about these experiments, Austin said.
There's a great deal of controversy over a project called HARP, short for the High Frequency Active Oral Research Program, being carried out by this country. The idea is to shoot a focused electromagnetic beam into the ionosphere. It's been billed as an academic program to improve worldwide communications. Some people speculate that it's mainly a military project aimed at a wide range of goals, from Star Wars defense to mind control. I don't know what to believe, but the project has its roots in the Kovács theorems.
You said something about a Tesla coil, said Austin. What did you mean?
It was a simple type of resonant transformer made up of two coils, actually. Pulses of energy are transferred from one to the other to produce a lightning-like discharge. You've probably seen them in the movies, where they seem to be a common fixture in the lab of the mad scientist. Gamay had been listening intently to the discussion. She leaned forward. "We've talked about the transmission of these waves into solid ground or the atmosphere," she said. "What would happen if you sent them into the bottom of the sea?" Hibbett spread his palms wide apart. "I don't have a clue. Ocean geology isn't my area of expertise."
"But it is mine," Paul Trout said. "Let me ask you a question, Al. Could amplified electromagnetic waves penetrate deep into the Earth's crust?"
"Without question."
"In that case, it's possible that the transmissions could cause some anomalies in the Earth's mantle in roughly the same way the HARP program you talked about disturbed the atmosphere."
"What sort of anomalies?" Adler asked.
"Whirlpools and eddies, possibly."
"Could these create disturbances in the sea?" Austin asked.
Hibbett pinched his chin.
"The swirling molten layer under the crust is what creates the magnetic field that surrounds the Earth. Any disruption of the field has the potential to cause all sorts of disturbances."
Professor Adler pounded his fist on the table.
"I knew I was right. Someone has been monkeying around with my ocean."
"But we're talking about vast distances and miles of surface material," Trout said, temporarily squelching Adler's exuberance. "My sense of this discussion is that it's going back to Joe's big spark plug, or Al's coil. Even if the device turned out enormous power, it would still be puny compared to the mass of the Earth."
Austin broke the brief silence that followed Trout's evaluation.
"What if there were more than one device?" He pushed the laptop to the center of the table and slowly spun it around so everyone could see the blips surrounding the disturbed area. Trout grasped the significance right away.
4 ships, each concentrating its power on a small area.
That might work. Austin nodded.
I'll show you something else that's interesting.
He called up the image taken shortly after the bell sank.
My guess is that one of these ships became a victim of the sea disturbances it created.
There was a murmur of agreement around the table.
That might explain how, Zavala said. What I can't figure is why.
Before we answer that question, Austin said, maybe we should concentrate on who. This isn't a case of someone making waves in a bathtub. Nameless and faceless people have gone to a great deal of trouble and expense to stir up the ocean. They have killed the crews of 2 ships that we know of and caused the loss of millions of dollars in property in their quest for some nameless goal.
He looked around the table.
Are we all ready to get down to work?
Hibbett started to rise.
I hope you're going to get more coffee, Austin said with a grin.
Hibbett looked embarrassed.
No. Actually, I was about to head into my office at Numa. I assumed that you had all you need.
Joe, tell Al about our Hotel California rule.
Glad to. It's like the old Eagles song, Al. Once you've been recruited into the special assignments team, you can check out, but you can never leave.
We need your expertise in electromagnetism, Austin said. It would be a great help if you could see from a technical point of view if these pipe dreams have any basis in reality. Where can we learn more about the Kovach theorems?
My best advice is to go right to the source. The research in this country was done in Los Alamos.
There's even a Kovach Society out there that's a repository for his work and documents. I've contacted them from time to time with questions.
Austin turned to Adler.
Could you work with Al and come up with a paper?
Joe, building a fleet of floating power plants is a pretty big deal. Those dynamos were probably commercially built.
I'll see if I can come up with a point of origin, Zavala said.
We could be in New Mexico this afternoon and back here tomorrow, Gamay said.
Austin nodded.
Find out how far those experiments went and if they're still going on. We'll work up everything ever written about Kovach. Maybe we'll find a nugget that will make it worth our while.
He thanked everyone for coming and suggested they meet the same time the next day. He and Zavala would get together in a few hours at NUMA headquarters. On his way back into the house, Austin passed his bookcase and noticed the volume on Plato. Shadows and Echoes. Echoes and Shadows. He wondered what Plato would have made of this new enigma.